of you lined up right here. And we have Alida Mangelsdorf. Hi, Alida.
Hi there.
And Charles Reed. Hi, Charles.
Good evening.
And thank you so much for coming in. You're with the North Coast Regional Water... It's a long title. North Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board. Is there a nickname for it we could...
No, we like to trip people up with that. So we like to keep it long.
Okay. Engineers, I know. Well, thank you for coming in. And there's been a drumbeat of things that are going to happen on the Russian River in terms of cleaning it up. You are part of that, and it'll be great to get that information out to the public, because changes are going to come, not immediately, but over the years. So it's good to get prepared.
Yeah, and thank you for giving us an opportunity to share our project.
Oh, great. Well, thank you. Thank you for coming in and taking time out of your lives to do it. Alida, what is your position at the board?
Well, I am an environmental program manager, and I manage a division of people who are planners and watershed stewards. So the group of folks that I manage are the folks who do a lot of the data collection and data analysis, the watershed assessment work. And we support restoration projects with grant funds and kind of keep and maintain our water quality regulations. So we're the planners of the agency.
Mm. And Charles?
And we are the permitters. I'm an engineer, and I oversee a lot of, about 20 staff who do permitting for discharges to surface water, discharges to land, landfills, cleanup projects, and stormwater. Mm.
So this is from individual homeowners to vineyards to
Yes,
a lot of coming into that.
Yes, we have a lot of permittees, yes. Mm.
Let's just get some scope of what the board covers. What is the area, and what does it do and govern?
Well, our board is the North Coast Regional Water Board, and we are one of nine regional offices, and our sort of parent agency is the State Water Resources Control Board in Sacramento. So each of our regional offices cover a given geographic region. Ours covers the area from the Oregon border down to San Antonio Creek, right at the Sonoma County and Marin County border. And we cover all the waters that discharge to the Pacific Ocean within that geographic area. And we're concerned about surface water quality. We're also concerned about groundwater quality.
What does that mean, surface water quality? So people who don't know what that means.
Yeah, it's a good question. The surface waters, when we talk about surface waters, we're really talking about rivers and streams and lakes and wetlands.
Okay.
And then when we talk about groundwater, we're talking about aquifers, and we're also talking about, you know, even the groundwater that's in sort of fractured bedrock that you might be able to sink a well into, but the water that's underground.
Okay.
So ours, as I say, is one of nine boards. We cover this North Coast region. We maintain a set of water quality regulations that are meant to protect the unique characteristics of the North Coast region and the unique activities that are underway in the North Coast. We're very different from the Central Valley, as you can imagine, very right. different from Los Angeles or San Diego. So the kinds of issues that we tend to focus on are things like forestry and agriculture. The Russian River is really one of those watersheds in our region that has the most sort of, you know, urban issues combined then with agriculture and recreation and timber and such.
That's true. Going up to the Oregon border, there's not many other bigger cities, I suppose, that would populated areas.
Yeah,
like
that's
this.
Right. The Humboldt Bay is probably the other area that stands out, but the Russian River is pretty unique in our region.
Yeah. 20 people you have to do that whole stretch of all those permitting that comes through the office.
Right, it's quite a challenge.
Yeah.
But we do have other permit programs too. I mean, we have a whole division of people who deal specifically with timbered lands, and we have a whole division of people who deal with kind of a new emerging water quality issue, which is all the cannabis grows in the region. And so the work that we do in Charles's division is really largely about facilities that are discharging, you know, waste through a pipe onto the either to be treated on the ground or as, you know, discharged into the surface water body itself.
And of course, those things are obviously usually, if they're not illegal grow, then it's obviously it's not known by anybody that that's being discharged.
Yes, that's right. We've had to employ a lot of creative tools to figure out where grows are, prioritize where the biggest issues are, try to disentangle all the variety of issues are, from, you know, pesticide use to water use to road building to grading of hillsides. So there are a number of issues associated with that particular use, and we're wrapping our arms around that.
Yeah, we work very closely with other agencies like the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, Division of Water Rights, and some of the local agencies to try to identify those legal grows.
I know, looking through the information, I didn't know that, but that we're officially, the Russian River is officially an impaired river, according to federal regulations. Can you explain what that means?
Yes, sure.
Who knew that we were impaired?
Well, our office has an obligation on a periodic rotation to look at all the available data, water quality data, and assess it to determine whether that data shows exceedances of given thresholds. And for the Russian rivers, in the early 2000s, I guess, when we looked at all of our pathogen-related data, we concluded that there was good evidence of a pathogen impairment. And
Now, for people that don't know what a pathogen is,
Yes.
We've got to get down to that level because...
I can help out with that. So a pathogen is an illness-causing organism. It could be something like a bacteria. It could be a virus. And it could be an amoeba. It's nearly impossible to monitor for individual pathogens. There are just so many thousands of them. So we tend to use a particular technique which uses an indicator bacteria, and that indicator bacteria is associated with, and this is a little indelicate, but is associated with fecal waste.
Right.
And so when we see that indicator bacteria in the water, it's an indication that there's been some discharge, and that discharge is what comes then with an array of possible pathogens, the viruses and bacteria that people may be shedding. And when it enters a public waterway, then we run the risk of having others exposed to it.
Right. How about animals, cows and things like that? How are pathogens from them separated, or can you discern them?
Yeah, there are a variety of pathogens that, cross species, but we're concerned generally about the discharge of fecal waste from, any controllable source, whether it be a domestic animal or a human source. We don't have in mind to control wildlife, and so there certainly is a signal that's associated with wildlife in our area. And the North Coast region in particular is fairly rural, so we see a fair amount of that. But what we've designed our monitoring techniques to try to discern the evidence of a human discharge versus one of wildlife, and really focus in on the sources that are related to humans.
When was the impairment started or put on the Russian River?
I actually am not going to remember the exact date, but it was in the early 2000s.
Okay, so quite a time.
It was 2002.
2002. Okay. And then by about 2011, we had designed a monitoring program, a whole monitoring study, to better understand the extent of that problem and what the sources might be. And so we conducted a series of studies, and the conclusions basically led us to understand that there are some land uses in the Russian River that have a particular risk of resulting in elevated pathogens, levels of pathogens that exceed thresholds. And those tend to be urbanized areas, other developed areas where there are septic systems, so rural residential areas, ag lands and shrublands where there's grazing. We didn't see a whole lot of concern coming from forest lands. Hmm. But the, in particular, the developed lands seem to come with an elevated risk of pathogens discharge. So the program that we've designed to try to control those sources really focuses largely on those issues.
So on the length of the Russian River then, are there, what are the areas that are of more concern to you as you go down from the, you know, way up above Ukiah, you know, all the pot, all the reservoirs up there?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're focused a little bit less on areas than we are on the types of sources. Hmm. And the sources are many. Municipal wastewater treatment plants who treat wastewater from larger communities and discharge it directly to surface water or through ponds. There are potential for leaking wastewater collection systems that convey the wastewater to the wastewater treatment plant. Municipal wastewater has a component of pathogens, including pet waste that might be within a city boundary. On-site systems, septic systems, are also a potential source. Ironically, the people who actually use and recreate in the river are sources as well. The river is very long. There are a lot of people who recreate, and there are no bathrooms along there. I don't know if you've had an opportunity to canoe down or kayak down. You know, when nature calls, there's no place to go.
Right.
So many people too far into that. But right. That certainly contributes to the pathogen load.
Right. And it's a tremendous amount of people do recreate in that in the river, well as pets as well.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Though I will say that from our monitoring data, what we concluded is that there is a concern during the summer when there's a large volume of people on the river. But really, the largest concern comes during the wintertime when there are storms that are flushing the landscape and stormwater runoff is carrying material into the river. And that's when we see the highest concentrations of our indicator bacteria. And I actually think of it as good news in terms of the way that we enjoy the Russian River, because obviously it's the summertime in which we have most of the recreational uses. Not all. There's certainly people who fish in the winter and canoe and make use of the river in the wintertime. But the largest risk or the largest potential impact would be during the summer. And thankfully, the largest concentrations are actually in the winter.
Mm-hmm. So after, say, a flood, how long does it take for the pathogen levels to sort of get back to a normal baseline?
You know, it's a really good question, and I don't think our data actually gives us a very good handle on how to answer that question. Okay. The monitoring we did was sort of a series of weeks during the dry season, so during the summer and then during the winter, over the course of two years. So we weren't really tracking sort of the whole length of time and a trend towards some normal range.
But generally at the beaches, it's generally thought that the bacteria concentrations start to decrease after about 3 days after a storm. Mm. But we haven't been measuring the rivers. But in the rivers, there are a lot more complications because often flooding is associated with sanitary sewer overflows from collection systems, and that can contribute to a lengthening of the period that the water might be seeing higher levels of bacteria.
In terms of the scope of the various studies and things, now we're talking about the Russian River, but there are a number of other tributaries. Are they major tributaries, small tributaries? What is the sort of scope of how far you reach within the watershed?
Well, I think there's a couple of ways of answering that question. I mean, one has to do with how we approached it from an analytical standpoint. We had a limited set of resources to design our monitoring study and to try to learn as much as we could with those resources. So we didn't go about the process of trying to characterize every tributary and every length of the main stem, and instead took an approach where we looked at different land uses and tried to associate those land uses with some risk of an elevated pathogen concentration. And then that way we could extrapolate to the whole watershed and say, you know, wherever there is this particular land use, there is the possibility of an elevated risk. Right. And so basically what we came up with was that the risk is higher in the winter, that developed lands, whether they're urban or rural residential, have a higher risk.
Like a storm runoff with oil and gas, things like that? Is that what?
Storm water definitely is, you know, brings with it pathogens. So yes, that's the, you know, a stormwater runoff that really is the sort of carrier of the pathogen issue. We also saw that there was a risk of elevated pathogens associated with ranch lands, so shrublands and agricultural lands. And we have a we had a couple of techniques that allowed us to see that there was a real signature from cows or from bovine grazing animals. Exactly. So those are the kind of the key areas where we know we need to focus. We need to focus on places where there are humans with sewers and septic systems. By extension, we also need to focus on areas where there are homeless encampments and there aren't any facilities. That also is an area of key risk. And then we also need to focus on places where there are concentrations of farm animals. So ranch lands, dairies, and other non-dairy livestock farms.
It gets a lot put into it, doesn't it? Into that river, quite a variety.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
I suppose locally, obviously, coming through the Laguna Santa Rosa, it spills into the Russian River as one of the major confluences, I imagine. And that is treated before it gets into the river. Is that
from the wastewater plant?
Yeah, from the wastewater plant.
Yeah, but the Laguna does have a from the monitoring data, a pretty sizable load from dairies, as you might expect. We got a lot of strong signals in our monitoring that bovine contributions were prevalent in that part of the watershed.
Mm-hmm. Maybe let's go back a bit. Let's go to the history again. Is that you create in the early 2000s, things were developed basically till 2011, and there was an actual plan. Mm-hmm. And what, where did that plan stand? Just to see how we got here.
Yeah, so that was a monitoring study that we designed. Mm-hmm. We went out and conducted that study. We had some help from Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. Mm-hmm. And we had a really talented fellow in our staff named Steve Butkus, who's since retired, but he had designed the study and conducted it. Following the completion of our monitoring study, we produced a staff report and kind of a plan, a proposed plan for how we might go about controlling the sources that we had identified. And that went out for public review in 2015. That was the first version of our proposal. So this is the pathogen TMDL that you highlighted as being sort of a scary name. And it's useful, I think, to think of it as a water quality recovery plan or something like that. And so the first version of it went out in 2015, and we held public workshops. It went out for public comment. We got a lot of written comments. We had a lot of people come to our workshops. And we got a lot of very strong and good feedback on the plan, on our approach, and basically were sent back to the drawing board on our on our approach, specifically with septic systems. We needed to do some better thinking on how to control septic systems. So we came back 2 years later in 2017 with a new report and a new plan. And again, it went out for public review. We got a lot more really good comment, and we were getting ready to finalize that report and bring it to our board when the fires happened later that year in 2017. Right. So we put it aside while we, all of us, dealt with the more pressing matters of the fire. And in the meantime, our state board adopted a new indicator bacteria objective. Which caused us to have to go back and look at our data all over again and analyze it now in comparison to this new threshold. So that brought us to 2019, when we were finally ready with a third and what turned out to be our final version. And that we brought before our board, which is a governor-appointed board, appointed board. There are decision makers. And we proposed this plan to them in August, and they approved it.
Wow. So now the hard work begins.
Exactly.
That's what I keep telling Alita, that the implementation part is really going to be the difficult part.
Except that's his part. My part was the planning.
Right. She hands that over to you on a plate.
Yeah, it's
here.
Funny how that works.
Yes, we're talking about, it's TMDL, is we're talking about the total maximum daily load, which seems very appropriate for what's going in there. Having a daily load. It's, I don't know who worked that one out, but I love it. As we were talking just before the break, Charles is has been charged with implementing this wondrous new plan.
Charged is the right word, I think. So it's been challenging, like we've been talking about. It's been challenging. We haven't had a real model to go by from other pathogen TMDLs throughout the state. There's been some new policies and new water quality objectives, like Alita referred to, that have caused us to take a slightly different tack than some of the other pathogen TMDLs that have been adopted throughout the state, and there have been a number. We've been trying to identify all of the sources that are potentially contributing, and our approach has been to have everybody do a little something. Mm. And it's easy for those sources that we already have permits on, municipal wastewater treatment plants.
Oh, yeah.
And they've been well permitted for decades. So they're used to new requirements. You may not be happy with all of them, but they're used to having to comply with requirements that we set forth.
Right.
There are other groups that that aren't well regulated, like septic systems, particularly existing ones that are in very old systems, like cesspools that were installed 50, 60 years ago.
Can you explain? You know, a lot of people live in cities, have no idea what a septic system is or a cesspool is.
Right. I came from Southern California, so when I came up here to work, half the systems seemed to be cesspools. What the heck? What are you doing?
Pretty ancient. It's 5,000-year-old technology.
Right, and they're particularly prevalent in the lower Russian River, roughly Summerhome Park and south. Those areas were vacation areas for San Francisco residents in the early 1900s. So they came here, they had vacation homes. They only stayed here for weeks at a time or a month or something. So the septic system was adequate for their month-long
use.
Very
low load, yeah.
Yeah, but as the demographics changed and the economy changed, those began to be occupied year-round. Mm. And they weren't really suitable for a year-round use, particularly larger families. So those systems were what are known as cesspools. Some refer to them as redwood boxes. It's essentially a hole in the ground with maybe redwood as a container to keep the hole intact. But it's essentially a hole in the ground. It really doesn't do much treatment. Modern systems have some sort of solid separation in a septic tank, and then the liquid fraction will go to a leach field or an effluent dispersal field. And those are more standard, conventional, modern systems. And they tend to spread out the waste and allow it to percolate so to get some treatment in soil, and it's much more protective.
Right.
So one of the focuses of this TMDL is to identify those old cesspools and other systems that are so old that they just don't function correctly, and they're more likely to contribute wastewater either directly through a straight pipe or overland flow to tributaries, and then ultimately make it to the Russian River. So we're focused on trying to identify those systems and have them corrected.
Right.
You know, so they're actually treating the waste.
Yeah, some form of treatment, minimal.
Yeah, that seems reasonable. I think everybody should have if they're going to be disposing of their own waste on site, it should be treated before it has a chance to resurface waters.
Right. Well, I said with all the recreation use, all the usages of that, that's got to be considered.
Absolutely.
And so, obviously, this type of program. These old systems, they've been there for 100 years. A lot of people are going to be pretty loath to wanting to improve them. What is the process this is going to take from the plan? And how long?
Yeah,
how
they've, it's remarkable. They've grown quite attached to these old systems. I think because they tend to at least in their minds, they work. You know, they get rid of the waste. They don't know exactly where the waste goes, but it doesn't seem to back up into their houses. So, so that's satisfactory in a lot of people's minds. But I think a lot of people recognize that that's probably, you know, this isn't 2019, almost 2020. There probably should be a more modern way to treat our own waste. But what I think people are most concerned about is potential cost. A lot of these areas in the Lower Russian River are on very small parcels that were their vacation homes.
Right.
So they really and they were all wedged in together back in the day. And the site conditions aren't really conducive to a modern septic system. It may not be large enough even to support something. So to
Because you need a certain square foot area for the septic system. Yeah.
That's right. So if you don't actually have if your parcel doesn't have the depth of soil and the area to be able to treat waste effectively, you have to do some pretreatment of it before it makes it to the system. And those systems can be pretty expensive. Mm. You know, $40,000-$50,000 for a system, and that understandably causes some concern and some fear, I think, from people down in the Lower Russian River. People who don't have the site conditions to support a conventional system. Right. So we've been trying to work with the Sonoma County and our State Board's Division of Financial Assistance to try to find funds, state funds that might be available. To help people upgrade their systems, to connect to existing municipal treatment systems like Russian River CSD, a municipal system, a kind of smallish municipal system that could potentially accept some of those, could be connected to some of those systems.
Which are nearby, right?
Right. There's some potential. Close enough, yeah. There's potential also for some small community systems, you know, 5 to 10 houses grouped together. So we're hoping we can find some money to help people pay for that because it could be potentially expensive.
How many people are we talking have these or properties have these type of pools and septics that?
Well, we don't know exactly, and that's one of the first things. One of the first things this program is endeavoring to do is find out what is out there because we don't know if an owner of a septic system out there. Hasn't come to the county for a building permit or if they haven't been a complaint issued against them, the county doesn't know what's going on there.
Right.
So one of the first things our program is going to do is reach out to all the property owners with a questionnaire to find out what exactly they have. And a lot of people don't know, actually, so they may have to go and find out pay someone to find out what kind of system they have. Right. There may be some records at the county as well. But we're going to find out what kind of systems are out there and those that are not complying with the TMDL requirements, cesspools and things that are and systems that are actively failing,
right.
Systems that are overloaded because people have built housing on a system that's only meant for one bedroom or the occupancy of the house is like a vacation rental, you know, that it far exceeds the capacity of the system to treat the waste and dispose of it properly.
Right.
So we're going to try to identify those and let those people know that they need to contact the Sonoma County PRMD, Permit Sonoma, to have those systems looked at to see if they can be repaired and upgraded in some way or whether they need to be replaced.
And what is the timing on that?
Well, we're going to start reaching out to these individual homeowners beginning in the end of summer and next year.
Hmm.
There's some processes that this TMDL effort has to go through for approvals, and there's an effective date we're assuming is going to be in the summer of 2020. So we're going to start at that point starting to reach out to these individual owners.
And what is the process from that point, how much time will they have?
That's a good question. We're expecting everybody to be in complete compliance with these requirements. So that means if they have to have a replacement of their system, to have it done within 15 years.
Hmm.
And if they're going to be involved with some sort of community solution, like connecting to an existing wastewater treatment plant, or if there's a small community system that needs to be created and constructed, they'll have an extra 5 years. So it could be up to 20 years if they're involved with that. Although if there are individuals who can upgrade their systems almost immediately, and there doesn't seem to be an option for them to have a community system, we were kind of expecting they'll do that as soon as they can. There is an ultimate compliance date of 15 years or 20 years, but we would like to see people comply as soon as they can.
So obviously some people won't want to, knowing people around here, that there'll always be some recalcitrant ones. How will that be dealt with, or have we got to that scenario?
We haven't gotten to that yet.
Okay.
I'd like to assume that everybody's going to comply.
Right.
But it's possible that some people will be more stubborn than others.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who don't want anything to do with the government. Mm-hmm.
Those people. And people are, like I said, rightly concerned that it's going to be expensive and they may not have the funds. Not everybody has $40,000, $50,000 lying around. So that's why we're trying to make funds available where we can. I think the Sonoma County will look for ways to help people comply and get funding.
Mixed in with that, you've still got to balance, obviously fish have got to live in the river. And all the recreation and vineyards. It's an interesting how you can balance, and also with the monitoring, make changes as, say, the years go by. There may be changes because of agricultural use changes and people's using less water or whatever.
Well, that's entirely right. And of course, there's always the issues associated with climate change. We saw the effects in the river this last winter with an atmospheric river event, which led to pretty substantial flooding. With flooding events like that, we will certainly see more spills and releases of things that we'd rather keep out of the water. And that's going to require that we think a little bit more deeply about our land use planning and zoning, and whether there are some specific kinds of facilities that should be moved out of a floodplain, for example.
The Russian River's flow is carefully controlled and monitored, isn't it, at all times? So that's part of, I suppose, to adapt to whatever's flowing into it. Can that be adjusted in that sort of macro view?
Are you thinking about the reservoirs?
Yeah, just in terms of the whole balance of the system, mm-hmm. How that's controlled to minimize the TM, to keep it below the requirements.
I think because the issues are most predominant in the wintertime, when there are far less of a control system in place. We're really at the mercy of the storm events themselves. I think there's just very little management, flow management, for example, that we can engage in that would help that matter. In the wintertime in particular, the issue is simply keeping waste on site and not allowing it to flow into the river. And, as I say, that becomes more difficult in times of climate change where we may be seeing more of these big flood events. So that's an issue that still needs more thinking and planning.
Yeah, because there is a lot of, in this area, obviously it's agriculture, there's a lot of on-site agricultural ponds, mm-hmm. which obviously can create an amazing amount of spillage.
Mm-hmm. No, that's right.
Unexpectedly.
And in fact, this last winter, we did see some of the dairy manure holding ponds, overtop, be breached essentially by flood by floodwater, so that we did see releases of that sort.
How does this system fix that? Is there a mechanism there for creating stronger, ponds or,
Yeah, well, those facilities are under permit. So we have quite a lot of leverage for those facilities to have them ensure that their waste storage units are not going to fail under these conditions. So I think we're going to be really looking to address those sources through our existing permitting. Where it gets a little bit more difficult is addressing sources that aren't well permitted, and that's where what we're doing with septic systems and septic systems were the source that we got most interest in this TMDL.
Yeah, because it can come at any from many different places at any given time. That an additional load.
Yep.
You know, that's the key, isn't it? And that's it, keeping it. Here we are. We've had a couple of years where we've had enough rain. Now, during the drought years, how does that change the situation?
Yeah, I don't think we have a good handle on, we don't have enough data just to say what statistical difference there might be between a wet year and a dry year in terms of the water year. Clearly, we have less stormwater runoff during dry times than we do during wet times. And stormwater runoff seems to be one of the main, sort of factors associated with moving, waste material across the landscape into a water body. There are other sort of interesting issues, though, associated with drought years that have to do with how a wastewater treatment plant functions. Mm. You know, when there are conservation measures put in place and people are actually using less water, you know, Charles can elaborate on this, but the sewer systems function less well when there's less water in them.
Yeah, the contaminants tend to be more concentrated. You know, with less, you know, we have the same amount of waste flow, but the less amount of water in the system to dilute things. Yeah, so that's one factor.
Because that could add, obviously, make the pathogens, you know, kick up tremendously then in the rivers under those situations.
There's less flow. Dilution flow, but yeah. I agree with that, but I think the fact that there is rainwater diluting the stormwater runoff tends to identify where there are bad practices. Mm-hmm. And what we're trying to do in the TAMDIL is identify those practices that need to change. So whether it's dry or wet, those sources are not contributing.
Right.
They just tend to contribute more in the winter when stormwater is and rainwater is starting to flush things. We want to try to address the sources so they're not there to be flushed.
Right, exactly. Now, this is quite a challenge, isn't it?
Yeah.
My goodness.
Yeah, we're trying to change some thinking and get people to take seriously this issue.
And now in terms of, you know, up the chain, I mean, this is a federal, and this all comes down from federal all the regulations and then filtered through the state. Is this how this all flows, basically?
Well, we have the Clean Water Act is a federal act, and it certainly describes a variety of obligations that we have in California related to water quality. But we also have our own Porter Cologne Water Quality Control Act, which was, in fact, written before the Clean Water Act. So it's a long-standing water quality protection approach. And it also defines sort of a whole program for monitoring waters, attending to sources of pollution, using permits, applying best management practices on land uses such as vineyards or grazing land or timberlands, and using technology in places like cities where you're treating municipal waste, for example. We will be returning, you know, periodically to the Russian River with our monitoring equipment, collecting additional data and sort of tracking trends over time and seeing how well the program that we've designed is doing at actually achieving pathogen thresholds that are protective of recreation and other uses. And as Charles, I think, mentioned, we have, our idea is that there's about 20 years probably of implementation and monitoring before we see those trends really improve. But I guess I would like to highlight that the Russian River is not the LA River.
Right.
You know, it's
not concrete.
It is not concrete. It is a functioning ecosystem. Despite the fact that we've identified it as impaired for pathogens, the issues in the Russian River are minor compared to some other places in the state. And, our real goal here is to basically control those things that are controllable. With respect to septic systems, that certainly means trying to come up with some funds to help people who wouldn't otherwise be able to afford the work that's necessary. But there are also other issues that are equally complex that we are going to need to figure out how to address, like homeless encampments, which are a clear source of waste to the rivers. and you know, are embedded in any number of social and economic factors that make the issue overall difficult to address. So our approach with a topic like homelessness and homeless encampments is really to work in coordination with the counties and the cities and come up with a coordinated plan that addresses the environmental issues as well as the social issues.
Well, that's it, especially along the Russian River. There's a lot of official and unofficial stewards mm-hmm. along the river, so you've got to somehow bring them all in to bring them along mm-hmm. With you.
Yeah, and honestly, that's the area of this program that is the least developed. You know, basically what we know is that we have to work with the counties and the cities to figure out some sort of coordinated plan, but the actual solutions are not immediately obvious. Mm.
But what everybody is in agreement on is that they want to have clean water that they can swim in right. and they can use for all their uses, their beneficial uses. So that and in that we are in agreement.
Right.
You know, some people are not happy with our approach. Some people are happy with our approach. And it's a balancing act, ultimately.
It is trying to do the right thing, but people get used to a certain way of doing things, and it's very hard to change,
yes. Yeah,
especially when there's a lot of money involved.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I wanted to highlight is that the Russian River watershed is filled with a lot of very smart and dedicated people.
Right.
And we saw that in spades in each of the iterations of our plan. We had a lot of people show up at our meetings. We had a lot of really good comment letters. And basically, you know, what we were able to do is take kind of the rudimentary science that we had laid out in our original monitoring plan and put it through that, you know, kind of social filter multiple times. Mm. And I think improve the plan in each iteration until we finally got to this year's plan that was adopted. Yeah. So we're actually really grateful for all the public involvement that we've had.
Oh, good. Well done. Can you give the public some information, how to get more information about what's happening, if they want to contact you or learn more about it?
Sure. We have a website. It's probably too long for me to give the whole address.
Okay.
But Charles has handed it to me, so I'll read it anyway.
I thought we would need that for some reason.
It's www.waterboards.ca.gov. And from there, you'll click on the North Coast region and look under water issues, and you will find our TMDL program and the Russian River in particular. Our office is just here up off of us on Sky Lane Boulevard near the airport.
Oh, yeah.
And Charles and I are always there and eager to answer questions.
Well, I really appreciate you coming in and telling us about what's happening along the Russian River.
Thanks for asking us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, Charles Reed and Alida Mangoldsdorf of the North Coast Region. I'm going to say it once more, North Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board.
You can call us the Water Board.
Okay.
At the end of the interview, we'll give you the shortcut now.
Kind of loosen up a bit, yeah. Really appreciate you coming in.
You're welcome.
We'll check back later and see how things are going as well.
Please do.
That would be great. Let's go out with a bit of Indigo Girls and Watershed.